Hey, Jeannie.
Hey, John R., we're back.
We
like a bad
are.
Dream in a virus, we're back. Yeah. Hi, everybody.
Welcome to BluePower.com. We got somebody wonderful here today, an old friend of mine, Mr. Harvey Cooper.
Uh-huh. And do you want to tell me who Harvey Cooper is in the scheme of things, apart from the fact that he has the dubious distinction of being your friend?
Yeah, well, I've known Harvey since the Star Waffle Shop in Detroit, Michigan, in 1964. And Harvey,
oh, wait, a Star Waffle Shop?
The Star Waffle Shop. Right, Harvey?
That's where we did all our business. That's
oh,
right.
My gosh, you guys are dating yourself. We don't even have waffles these days unless they're Belgium.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we'll get on with it. We're going to ask Harvey a lot of questions. He has some wonderful insight as to how the music business ran and is running to this very day. So, tell you what, first, though, let's play a record that that Harvey promoted.
All right. You want to tell me what the name is? Is this the Raindrops one?
This is D. Clark and Raindrops.
Oh,
all
man.
Right?
I remember that.
Blow it.
All right.
It feels like raindrops falling from my eyes, falling from my eyes. Since my love has left me, I'm so all alone. I would bring her back to me, but I don't know where she's gone. I don't know where she's gone. Rain keeps falling from my eyes. Oh no, it can't be teardrops, for a man ain't supposed to cry. So it must be raindrops, so many raindrops. It feels like raindrops falling from my eyes, falling from my eyes. Oh, there must be a cloud in my head. Rain falling from my eyes. Oh no, it can't be teardrops, for a man ain't supposed to cry. So it must be raindrops, so many raindrops. It feels like raindrops falling from my eyes, falling from my eyes. Keeps on falling, falling from my eyes.
You gotta be kidding. They actually just did that straight live. I mean, that guy's hitting notes like that live.
That's right.
And he's not he doesn't get a chance to overdub. This is live to two track.
Live to two track.
That was it. And during those during that time, yeah. That
yeah.
was That's how it,
that's how it was yeah. done.
It was.
You promoted that record, Harvey.
I did, and it brings back some incredible memories because it was part of a company that I represented called VJ Records.
Who was responsible for VJ Records?
I can't say. I don't want to say. No,
yeah,
it was.
What does VJ stand for?
Vivian and Jimmy Brackett.
Yeah.
Ah, so that might be a clue as to who's behind. See,
well,
that's
they were
Nikki
a couple out of Chicago. That was not their business. They had another business that was questionable.
Yeah.
Don't put it that way. And for some strange reason, they had a group of people around them, creative and business-wise, that constructed this independent company that gave forth many classic hits for all time.
Yeah.
Including, you know, D. Clark and...
Well, they had
Four Seasons and the Beatles' first
That's
recordings.
Right. That's
wow.
right.
Jimmy Clanton. It goes on and on and on. Jerry Butler, The Impressions.
That's
where do you want
right.
to stop?
Oh, yeah. The Impressions. Jerry Butler.
This was an independent company out of Chicago.
So you worked.
But where did you work these records? Did you work Chicago? Did you work the Midwest?
I started in Detroit, as you know, for a music distributor, which is now the Handelman Company.
Yeah.
Johnny Kaplan, JK Music Distributing Company.
Johnny's still there.
Is it Johnny still alive? I don't know if he's still alive or not. I don't think so.
He was old when I was working there. When
he was
I worked
quite a
at
character. Arc. Quite a character.
Yeah, he was a character.
But in those days, I mean, you know, when you work for a music distributor, you know, you came from the same school I did. I mean, they were a complete company. They did everything in the music business with the exception of actually manufacturing the records and actually producing the records.
Yeah.
But they did all other functions.
That's right.
And that's how we learned. Thank God we were able to see and function in all the various areas of the business.
When I started in Atlanta, I worked for a record company called NRC Records, and they had a pressing company just down the road. Mm-hmm. So they told me, well, if you're going to engineer, we want you to learn how the records are pressed. So I think they got 2 weeks of free work out of me up behind a steam table in a record press, learning how, you know, you put the pieces of plastic on, the virgin plastic, on the steam table to make it malleable. Then you put the plastic in the press, and you push the button, and the press came down, and it pressed it. And you cut the over to and put it, this big 45 with a big raggedy edge on it, and you put it in another thing and go like this, and the damn thing would cut the flash off the edges.
Yeah, I remember.
But
they
put the label on and pressed the record at the same time.
You know, it's a far cry from today where I have this nice little CD burner here that basically you just put a little brand new CD in there. And there's no sweat involved. And you push a little button and it does it for you. And then you push finalize and you say, hey, wow, I'm a record producer.
That's right. It's a little different today.
It's a lot different.
But I met Jeannie. I met Harvey after I'd been hired out of Atlanta up to Detroit, and by an independent promotion company, a distributor.
Right.
Right. And it was called, what was the name of Schlees and Silverman's? Merit Music.
Merit Music.
Merit Music.
Mm-hmm. I actually worked with them for a little while later on.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice people. Very nice people.
That's one perception, yes.
Yeah. John Schlee was a nice man.
He was a nice man.
Yeah, Gene Silverman wasn't too bad. He always treated me nicely.
I think he needed to. I think he had some issues.
I knew this was going to be good, folks. I knew it was going to be good.
I couldn't take it in. 8 months is all I could handle.
I remember that Gene Silverman picked me up one morning and said, I'm going to take you and introduce you to the guys here and from the various companies. And we go to this place called the Star Waffle Shop, which is on 2nd, right?
That's right.
On 2nd, right across the street from WJBK.
Exactly.
Right. And the Star Waffle Shop is just like, I think it was Greek-owned or something, and they had booths.
Yeah, it was a typical, you know, Midwestern coffee shop.
Coffee shop.
Did they serve waffles?
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, yes.
Hockey pucks.
Your choice them, I don't know. I, don't
well,
know
I was going to say, your choice of syrups? Or
I don't know. But
we
remember,
were all there, the Hawkeye wares, period.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
They were in there.
Food was incidental.
All the guys were there. Harvey Cooper was there. Sammy Kaplan was there in his shark skin suit and his little little velvet shoes with little gold bears or something on.
I didn't know there were people like this that existed in the Midwest.
Well, yeah, everybody had a shark skin suit on. Everybody was neat and clean except me.
What's a shark skin suit?
Okay, because I never wore a suit. And
what is a shark skin suit?
A shark.
It's a very shiny little fabric, you know, that if
like
it,
that
you get caught in
silk?
The sun, you could get blinded, actually.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Big cufflinks.
It's almost like silk, in a, just about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, all the mobsters, the wise guys wore sharks.
Our mentors.
Yes, our mentors.
I want to know, how come is it that there's so many people that that have had, like, weird, shady backgrounds that decide to jump into the music business? It just makes the rest of us look really shady.
Well, in those days, you could really get rich quickly. You didn't need a pedigree. If you had a hit record, that was it.
Yeah.
Could get you there quick.
I like that word, pedigree. So anyway, I go in a hillbilly, okay, and And Gene is taking me around. This is Sammy Kaplan, and this is Harvey Cooper. And this is Sol Starr. And Sol Starr goes to me. Goes, who the fuck is this? It says to Gene Silverman, and Gene says, this is a new man I hired. He said, where did he come from? What? You don't look like us.
We don't want no stinking guy that don't look like us.
It was so funny, but I made some great friends, and Harvey's one of them. And Harvey,
same here, John.
Harvey went on to become a major player in the music business. And like I said in the blurb on the front page, from promo man to president, Harvey became vice president of RCA Records. And then president of 20th Century Fox Records.
Wow.
So he was instrumental in an awful, awful lot of records, a lot of stars, and, you know, played a big role.
Did you, as president and vice president, play any role in the signings of artists, or was in those days completely left up to A&R?
Well, that's really a good question. I mean, at RCA, had no role in new talent. Mm-hmm. At all, other than they would ask my advice, and once product was made, I mean, I think they were very interested in my impression, mm-hmm. and but I had no say in it because they had in those days they had their own staffs.
Yeah,
they didn't go to the outside to produce records.
Mm-hmm.
They had in staff
writers and
A&R,
producers.
Absolutely, yeah. And everything was done within house.
Mm-hmm.
That was the style in those days at the major companies.
Well, that was actually a reflection of how the movies were, the studio lots, and
exactly.
People would be contract players, and I'm sure that was pretty much what was going on in business.
Well, there was no question. As a matter of fact, I mean, that was one thing that that stayed in my mind all those years. I mean, I was always a big fan of the early movies, the 30s, the 40s, and the system, you know, that they developed. I call it the star system. I've heard it mm-hmm. referred to in that way,
mm-hmm.
and it always burned a little something in my head about that procedure and how they developed all these unique stars over time,
mm-hmm.
and I used it to my advantage on many occasions.
Did you really?
Oh yeah, absolutely. When I was at 20th, I was ahead of everything.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was ahead of the new talent, and I signed the talent. I developed what we had,
mm-hmm.
and I ran the show from that point of view.
Wow. So when you said that you took advantage of your position, in what ways did you take advantage of it?
Well,
signing people that you knew of, that you believed in? Did you have
Well, it's
a
interesting.
More
clout? It's like the you know the those Eastern Europeans came to Hollywood, you know.
Yeah.
They had a staff of people around them, a cadre of people who knew talent basically.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm.
And once they confirmed talent, whether it be a man or a woman or a group of people, they would develop it over time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can see it so succinctly in these famous pictures of the past. There's one picture I see all the time. It's about an MGM. They had a luncheon for their stars.
Yes. Yeah.
In the 40s.
Yeah.
And it's every star you ever yeah. heard of in
table.
Your life,
sure.
Only at one studio there,
yeah.
And they were all unique, incredible stars that they developed themselves,
right,
using
sure.
the system, and that's exactly what I did at 20th.
Wow.
And they're not doing it anymore.
Yeah, in
develop being the key word.
Yeah, development is definitely the key word. I mean, sometimes, as you know, John, I mean, talent comes when it comes.
That's right.
On the level we're talking about,
yeah.
I mean, the last time it happened to me was some kid. You know, I had an office in Beverly Hills with this guy when I first started an independent company, and some guy knocks on my door. Hi, a fella in Chicago asked me to stop by, you know, and I'm play my tape for you. I said, "What's your name?" He says, "Richard." I said, "Richard, play me your tape, will you?" He says, "Fine." So anyway, place the tape, and I listen to, you know, how A&R guys listen
yeah.
to stuff. You listen up to the hook, boom, next, you know. You think you know it all
Which makes us as artists feel so secure.
yeah,
but that's based on knowledge experience over time.
Yeah.
And believe me, it works. It's like your doctor. He can tell you if you're sick just walking towards him, you know.
I don't know. My doctor charges me for throat cultures every time I have a sore throat, so I don't know.
Anyway, this kid, you know, plays his tape, and I said to him, I said, you know, do me a favor, kid. I said, go outside the door again, knock on the door again, take your tape, and take the shirt out of your pants, you know, and leave it there, and then come back in. And he does like a schmuck, you know. And he comes back and he says, why did you make me do that, Mr. Cooper? I said, because how dare you, kid, walk in my office perfect. Who do you think you are? You
know? And who was this Richard guy?
It was Richard Marks.
Richard
Marks.
Oh,
my God.
Oh, my God.
Oh, there's no question in my mind.
It don't mean nothing.
I'm telling you, and you could have heard it was not those tapes, but it was pretty close to what you, what came later. And his father, you know, his father was an ad guy in Chicago, and his mother was the Quasar lady, you know, the background.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Quasar! And that was his mama.
So that's where he gets his falsetto from.
Exactly. And he had this, you know, 24-track studio to play with. That was his play. That was the only.
He had his own?
Yeah. It was his father's
the
studio.
The bastard, man. I mean,
so anyway, I called his dad. I said, hey, this kid's a star. I'd like to manage him. Uh-huh. You know, he says, well, what do I need you for? I know everybody. I'm in the business. I said, look, you know, let me tell you something, Mr. Marks. I said, that may be true, and you may know a lot of people, but when you meet, you know, Hollywood people in Chicago, they're a little bit different than when you meet Hollywood people.
Yeah, their noses are bent.
You know, they don't hardly remember you. And I said, look, your kid is going to make it with or without me. It'll take him 5 years without me. Mm-hmm. Well, it took him six.
Six.
So basically, that was what happened. But the whole idea is that to have that feeling.
Yeah.
That understanding that, God, this, you know, this kid's going to be a gift to the world. I mean, his music is going to be something, and I can validate it because I was trained and so on, and it was a terrific thrill when you meet talent like that.
Well, speaking of raw talent, there was a very famous piano man.
Right.
By the name of Mr. Billy Joel.
Right.
Who you have had some run-in with. And, in fact, you brought us something.
Well, I didn't actually have a run-in with him, but I knew people around him.
Uh-huh.
And I knew about an album and some things that he did on an independent basis prior to signing with any major company. And I remember the song so very well because I couldn't believe it was him, you know. And maybe 15 years later, after I had first heard this song, I heard it again. On a special, a homeless special. So I looked up the guy who produced it. I said, give me that tape. I said, that's one of Billy's first songs that he ever wrote. And I kept it through the years. So it's got to be 30-some-odd years old.
Yeah, I'm looking at probably one of the...
And I mean, if I had to play it and say, guess who it is, you'd never guess.
Never guess.
No,
never
and
guess.
I think we ought to play it because it's really a hoot. When I first heard it, I'm thinking to myself, you have got to be kidding. I mean, he sounds wonderful in it, but he sounds like he's got bipolar vocals.
Absolutely.
There's two different types of vocal powers in there. The only thing that I see that is clearly classic Billy Joel is in his walks down and his chords.
And
you could say, oh, yeah, that sounds like Billy Joel, but anything
and
else
And the lyrics,
doesn't.
I mean, there's some the lines in there that are killer, and if you can get about, above the schmaltz, you know, the schmaltzy production.
Well, I like schmaltz. And for 30 years ago, and frankly, we're playing it on the world's oldest cassette. I think this is probably the second cassette ever made.
Absolutely.
So let's see if
it's a good place.
It's just an interesting thing I've kept with me.
Hit it, Billy.
To see tomorrow, 'cause I saw it yesterday.
I most particularly like that episode of Wipeout at the end.
<laughs> yeah, they're really going at it.
Now, who produced that?
I really don't know. You know, this is one artist you played today that I had nothing to do with personally. I want to make that clear.
Okay.
It's just something that struck me about him in the early days, you know, and I kept it with me for over 30 years.
It shows your ear.
Yeah,
okay.
Definitely.
I just love it.
I do, too.
Yeah.
That's a very elaborate production for a new artist, though, so I was just questioning whether the producer behind him was...
I don't really know. I'll be honest with you. I don't know. It was an independent... it was his first album.
Wow. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's very... Again, if I were an A&R and a guy like Richard Marx were to walk in, or a guy like Billy Joel were to walk in, that would be the kind of person I'd sign. But it seems like in today's business... The art of songwriting is taking a back seat to the art of youth ass kissing. And
thanks, Jeannie.
I'm sorry. You know, and being a member of youth, you know, it's something that I've found kind of a dilemma. What do you think? Do you think songwriting has changed over the years, or?
I think it's been disguised somewhat.
In what format?
Well. You know, the word commercial is an interesting word. I mean, a lot of people, you know, shrink back for it like they just saw Dracula, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like they're
commercial.
Yeah, commercial.
Commercial.
Yeah. Well, and now a word
all commercial
sponsor.
Means is that a lot of people like it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have different trends and different cycles in every business, and we find the same here. Now, when you look at it, new music that's been created, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, it's all been done by amateurs.
Yeah,
and it's all been in a form that that was not really a musical form, you know, in its start. For example, the punk rockers, you know, of the late 70s and the 70s.
Yeah.
It was a way by which young people could talk to each other in England.
Uh-huh.
They were in this class situation in their lives, and they didn't think they could rise above their class, and they started to puncture themselves with metal and
sharp objects,
rip their clothes and so on.
Sure.
And it's interesting, and everybody was so revulsed by it. You know, 10 years later, a guy was wearing white shoes and white belts in the suburbs was now slashing his jeans. You know,
that's right. Yeah.
It takes about a decade for this to cross over into the real world. But the clothing became, a symbolic of that period.
Did you sign any of these punk artists? Did you follow that trend by any chance?
I personally did not, because it starts to become musical as it goes on.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden there's rhythms, all of a sudden there's melody lines, and somehow, one way or the other, it becomes commercial in the long run.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing applies to rap.
Yeah. Well, I've been looking at rap also very subjectively, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And on certain levels of it, I really, really appreciate the cleverness in some of the lyric writing, the rhythm of the lyric writing. And a lot of it reminds me of Jamaican music back when I was in Jamaica back in the 80s. That whole rhythm type of thing. I really appreciate that. What I don't appreciate so much is the fact that now, what I really don't like as a musician is I don't like people saying, I like this song, or this is my music, and there isn't a shred of music. You get ears, and you get a little bit of drum, like boom, bop, boom, boom, and then the only music that they're getting seems to be lifted from something that Patrice Rushton did, back in the 70s.
Or Brenda Russell,
or Stevie Wonder. The real songwriters are getting lifted and sampled and looped, and it seems like some of today's generation poets don't know the first damn thing about music, and I hate it when they say, my music is this, because there is no music involved.
Yeah.
Well, a hook could be almost anything. A hook could be a lyric. It could be rhythm.
Have you been able to sing along with a rap tune recently?
No, I don't think I'm going to play it at my next wedding.
Would you cover it?
No, but I see what's going on here. I mean, I understand the evolution of it and why it is.
Uh-huh.
Just like any other new music, again, it was a form of communication.
Yeah.
Right.
For a culture, okay? Mm-hmm. And now it's become more than that. And as a result of that, there was a political backlash.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, rap made country huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
There was a
now,
backlash.
How do you figure that?
Well, because I think, and again, I want you to understand that this is not a racist remark, but there's still about 11% a black population in this country, you know. But if you listen to the radio and you see television movies, you see much more product than relates to that 11%.
Right.
And I think that Caucasian people or non-black people started to embrace other forms of music because that's all they heard more amount of that in the media. Mm-hmm. So they went to other forms of music. I would say Caucasian people embraced country music and it became the pop music of the late 80s, 90s.
That would be the older generation Caucasians, because I can say that my nephews are all rap listeners, and typically, true to form, white people do have a nice and interesting habit of borrowing liberally from fellow cultures. And there's a number of, what was that white guy that, he was a white guy, rapper. What was his name?
Vanilla Ice.
And there's a number of white people that have listened to it. And, in fact, when I go driving by young kids in their little samurai jeeps, they're rapping. You're hearing a lot of rap coming out of their stuff.
Yeah.
So, and again, I think rock and roll originally back in the 50s stemmed from the blues and jazz, and it was a black thing, and the whites lifted it off of it and made a fortune off of it. And,
well, there's no question. I think it's all been tied up into our culture. I mean, everybody has put forth some effort into it. I mean, Paul Whiteman said, do you remember Paul Whiteman who he was?
I had
big
one
music in the 20s.
Orchestra leader.
Yeah. I mean, he said, he had a famous quote. He said that jazz music came to this country in chains 300 years ago.
That's right.
And basically, that's true. I mean, where the hell would we be without the black rhythms and black writers and artists and so on?
That's right.
What I'm saying is that country, became the new pop music.
Yeah.
And I would dare say that there was a big cross section of people that embraced it. I think there's been a shakeout since that time. you know. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of what we call legit music happening. But you notice it has to happen like around the corner kind of thing. It's got to come out of a movie, you know. Yeah.
Yes, that's another thing I've noticed is the advent of soundtracks.
Right.
That's really, you know, where an artist now wants
to
get
it's not hip enough to play, you know, on CHR. It's got
to
be hipper than hip.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hipper than hip.
Hipper than hip.
Yeah, it's got to be hipper than hip.
Well, I tell you what, we were also at the beginning of the show. We were looking through product to play.
Yeah.
And you, I asked you if you ever worked Joe Tex.
Yes.
Did you ever have him on the road? Did you ever take him out?
Gentleman, very nice man. He was part of the Atlantic.
Who's Joe Tex?
Joe Tex.
He was an artist on Atlantic
Records.
Oh,
yeah. Uh-huh. He was the greatest mic handler I have ever seen. In fact.
Good-looking guy.
Yeah. In fact, remember, I don't know, but I saw him the first time I ever saw him live was at the 20 grand.
Yeah.
And he would stand in the middle of the stage, and he had all his musicians lined up on each side.
Right.
Okay. The drummer was right behind him on a riser, but all the rest of the musicians were right in the same level as Joe. And the only difference was is that he threw that mic. That mic was like an extension of him. I'll tell you who learned mic handling from him was from The Who, Roger Daltrey.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And Rod Stewart.
Rod Stewart swinging the mic, pushing the microphone stand out, bringing it back in.
How about James Brown? Could he have learned that from him?
Nobody learned anything.
No.
Him.
No. But why don't we play a little Joe Tex right now?
Good idea.
Papa was too.
Baby, you can call me that. My papa was. 'Cause I never done working from morning till night, and the money didn't seem to ever come out right. No. Papa was a tramp, but he was a lover too. So why can't I do like Papa do? Horror, like a Papa do. Like a Papa do that. 'Cause I'm his son. Why can't I be like my daddy? Lord, I'm nasty. All right, if you want to call me that, go ahead. I guess Papa was too. Just 'cause I don't take it. Nobody's mess. I'll get mad in a minute and jump in your chest. Low down, all right. Papa was too, but he was a lover too. So why can't I do like my papa do? All right, like a papa do. Like papa do. I'm his son. I wanna be like daddy. Be like my daddy. Oh. All right, call me Paul too. 'Cause Papa was. Oh, yes, he was. Just 'cause I got a hose in both of my shoes. And I cover them holes with the daily news. Papa was bold. He was a lover too. So why can't I do like my papa do? Or like a papa do now. Like my papa do. 'Cause I'm his son. Can't you understand? I wanna be like my daddy. Be like my daddy. Son, don't you mess with me now. Just 'cause I wanna hang around and do nothing but newspaper in my shoes.
Mr. Joe Tex. Like Papa was. Papa was too. That was a big hit, wasn't it?
I love that record, yeah. It reminds me of that Atlantic Records, early Atlantic Records era, you know, and Zillion Stars, another.
Did he come out before James Brown or after James Brown?
After.
He came out after James Brown. James, Please, Please, Please is the first record I remember about James Brown. It was on Federal Records. King Federal out of Cincinnati. What was his name, the owner of that company? Jesus, Jeannie and I did a show on King.
Well, they had their own distribution and everything. I remember.
Yeah.
Great label.
The best.
Yeah.
Boy, when you said he was handsome, Joe Tex is handsome.
Very good looking.
Wait, let me see that.
He was a very good looking
man. Oh, ladies, wait a minute. For all of you girls in my generation and younger, I got to tell you, this guy is a hunk of burning love. My goodness. My goodness. Can I have. Oh, my God. Look at this picture of him. Girls, you should probably get a copy of this album. Just it's from Rhino Records.
It's on Rhino now.
Uh-huh.
A Rhino re-release.
And our nicest guy you ever met in your life.
And a gentleman.
Very gentle and very bright.
Wow.
Yeah. And look at it. Look what on the front cover. Look what he's holding.
What? A microphone.
The microphone. Man.
So this is the guy that you say. Now, did he have like a particular school or were people just watching him? When you said Roger Daltrey picked up his microphone techniques from him and stuff.
Well, it seems to me that the first time I ever saw that happening was with Joe Tex.
Yeah, he could do it.
And then I saw Daltrey doing it and a couple other people. Rod Stewart was into it. That's exciting.
What became of him? Where is he now?
I don't know. I mean, he had two or three hits, and I think they stuck with him a long time. And
he
faded, and I never heard from him again.
Hey, he did Ain't Gonna Bump No More with No Big Fat Woman. That's Joe Tex.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
No, he had three, four legit hits.
Yeah, he had let's see here. I got
that. Oh, my God. I loved that song. I used to crack up listening to that. I guess that shows how old I am.
Yeah, here we go.
A Sweet Woman Like You
was
a big one. SYSLJFM was another big hit for him.
What does that sound? What?
Papa Was Too. Show Me was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Show Me a Man That's Got a Good Woman.
So he had four or five really good hits.
Skinny Legs and All. That's another good one.
Yeah, he wrote that about
me. All these guys, I mean, they all operated very much the same way. We had hundreds of healthy independent record companies.
And what happened to them?
Who had as much right to the charts as the major companies did.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Wasn't payola a big thing back in those days?
What was that one?
Huh? Payola?
What word?
Payola.
So what I'd like to know is where did these indies come up with the money for these fine productions and then come up with the money to promote it?
Well, you have to understand also that during those years that there was no duplication. There was no pirating.
Right.
So the profits were enormous, number one.
Uh-huh.
And number two, there was if you notice that you couldn't have two or three radio stations in a market. You couldn't have but one newspaper. I mean, you know the lawyers, they found loopholes. And they found ways to try to, basically restrain trade.
Yeah.
Wow. And look at what happened.
But the majors were always trying to do that.
Yeah. Well, can you blame them? They don't like competition.
Yeah, I can blame them. I mean, they killed a healthy business. I don't think it's just the record business. I think that it's a societal thing.
Yeah.
And you can see all businesses are merging, and the big guys ate the little guys up. And it's killed a lot of creativity in my eyes.
Killed the independents, which killed the creativity.
Exactly.
But the mergers. I mean, the big record companies today are sweating it.
Well, listen, I mean, if you look today, it was funny. I called somebody at the Gavin sheet, Bill Gavin.
Yeah, sure. I was in the Gavin report. Yeah, I've been in the Gavin report a number of times.
The Gavin report was what, about 10 sheets of blue paper?
That's right, blue paper.
Right.
But it was like a Bible. It was respected.
Yeah.
Whatever those people said, that was it.
Bill Gavin.
You knew it was the truth.
Yeah.
And now we got all the, we went from four charts, basically,
to 100
about
charts.
29 charts.
Yeah.
Billboard
yeah.
now has got control.
And it all has to do, it's not the money, it's the money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's the mentality change of the business. I would say, if we went from, I think we're all parasitical of the talent, to give me the money, baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know Doug Morris at Billboard?
Yeah, very well.
I had heard that they didn't put their blues edition out this year, which they used to do every year. And so I called and I left a message and I wrote him an email and I wanted to know from him why it was that they didn't.
Did he return your call?
Well, no, he didn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I wrote him another letter, to which he wrote a scathing reply. Well, first, I was on vacation. And second,
since you're
copping attitude,
right there. Now you're pissing me off about the business. The one thing that I'm angry about in all these years that I put into this business is what you just touched on right now.
Yeah.
The veterans of our business turn their backs on the other veterans
That's
of the business.
Right.
and I'm pissed, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Doug doesn't really care because he's, you know, he's got his gig and his gig is secure. And Billboard now is
it's not
the
only
top
him.
Of the heap.
You know, there were others, but you know, people are in our business. Like I said, there's no pedigrees, and when you make a few bucks, they get a little haughty.
Oh, let's, boy, you know have I, mean? I seen that in droves. Yeah, that's always disgusting to watch.
Show me a hit record, Doug. You know, show me one that you made.
Well, listen,
you
and he knows better because he's a good record man, and I worked very hard on his early recordings and in his the original label, you know, Lobo and those people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
was he in the – I didn't know that he – I thought he was just a writer.
No, he owned the record company.
You're kidding.
He and a guy by the name of Dick Vanderbilt.
Well, then I owe him an apology.
In the 60s, there was a guy giving out million-dollar deals.
No way.
Honest to God.
In
Ampex.
The 60s?
Ampex.
Ampex, sure.
The tape manufacturer.
Yeah, they had GRT records.
Decided that they were going to give out millions of dollars to people in the record business to start businesses.
Wow.
I had an artist on one of their labels.
And we had a lot of their deals at Bell Records. Remember old Bell Records?
Oh, yeah.
Which is now Arista Records?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Another company. I remember I was Bell Records, and I still have the plaque today. We had the number one, the number two, and the number three record in the country.
Wow.
An independent company.
That's right.
It's never going to be done again.
Yeah.
Not to mention the number nine, the number 16. We had about 10 or 11% of the charts.
Did you have Precious and Few or any of those?
We had the lights all down in Georgia. Right, and all of the English stuff and the Four Seasons and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah.
We had hit after hit after hit after hit. But anyway, because there was a fair break, anybody can get a really good record played. That's what they were interested in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Today, you know, you have consultants and you have this and third-party marketing people. Again, the lawyers, thank you so much for making it okay to be amoral.
Yeah, they've done an awful lot to take the fun out of music, and I think one of the greatest things to ever have happened is to see the holy feet left from all of these record companies shooting themselves in the feet. And the feet prints left now are very holy, but it's left some wide gaps for us artists. And because of MP3 now, we can contact our audience directly, and we don't need their stinking help anymore.
Well,
the stinking help.
We don't need their stinking help.
They have a net out there that is so fine and so well-tuned that they can detect any unusual happenings. Okay. So basically nothing's changed, you know, in the marketing world. Mm-hmm. This is the simplest business in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a simpler business. Mm-hmm. It's all about making stuff and selling it.
Right.
Period.
That's it.
Yeah.
I don't
care
what anybody tells you. Some things never change.
Right.
So basically you got to get to the market in one way or another.
Right. Right.
So,
you still have to anticipate what is it that the market is wanting. And one of the things that I've seen consistently happening is that the record companies, with all of their clout, all of their money, and all of their brainwashing abilities, they have managed to successfully convince kids that this is what's acceptable to listen to, that this is what you should be buying. And, of course, they count on the peer pressure to force children into this. And you listen to what kids are listening to today. And I feel like I'm sounding like my parents when the Beatles first came out and they were going, oh, all that, yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't have a problem against rap. I don't have a problem against today's music. But I do have a problem with it being shoved down our throats and on heavy rotations and
right.
stuff like that, where you don't really have any choice to listen to any other artist.
Well, you do. You do, and people still break through. I mean, you know, the guys who were doing New Age music 10
mm-hmm.
years ago, 15
yeah,
years
Wyndham
ago.
Hill was a classic example.
Well, yeah. They found a hole in the marketplace, and they did it themselves. They got to the marketplace.
Yeah.
What I'm saying to you is that even the most moderate foray into the commercial world will tell you volumes about your commercial viability.
Yeah.
But you got to know how to do it.
Yeah.
You know how to get enough exposure to find out. Once you do, everybody
will
know
about
it.
How do you recommend that people get enough exposure in today's day and times as opposed to the times, the golden era of the recording industry?
I do seminars on the subject, and that's how I built my business. I'm a consultant. I mean, people come to me with those questions.
Uh-huh.
How do I do it?
Uh-huh.
You know, well, first thing you want to know is how do I stay at a point in time? You know, with my music, and I may be eight people at the same time. If I'm a writer and a publisher and I own a record company, I'm a performer and a recording artist, and so on. You got to find out, you know, who you are and what level you're on. at a point in time. That's right. Number one. And number two is you have to define who your audience is.
Right.
And then you got to get to the audience in one way or another.
Okay.
And the thing to do is to get involved with people, like myself, experienced people who know the business.
Right.
And can get you there. Now, you can't have a bunch of nice guys or family members. I'm sure they're well-meaning, but they can't get you to the marketplace. Yeah. So if you came to me, I mean, I could tell you the cheapest and the best way to get to the marketplace. I mean, you're going to get more bang for your buck, obviously, on the radio. Mm-hmm. There's still people that play new artists.
Mm-hmm.
But they play them because of people like me, not because of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
But once the artist is exposed and accepted by the consumer, then that artist can do anything they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can go from there. But it is possible. So surround yourself with people who know what they're doing. Get to the marketplace and find out if you're commercially viable or not. But, I mean, there's other little tricks of the trade. I mean, you got to get into stores.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is instead of waiting for a distributor who is not going to help you
create
the demand, give them the bloody records free.
Mm-hmm.
Set up a marketing atmosphere.
Right.
So if you're getting played and you have records in the marketplace and you check back in those stores and it's selling, hello, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
If you look like a duck and you talk like a duck and you waddle like a duck, guess what?
You're a
duck.
Goose.
Yeah,
exactly.
Now listen, yeah. You want to, before we leave,
sure.
You got to tell people how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, including me, because I got to talk to you. I mean, let me ask you something else. Do you think that controversy helps in selling an album?
Sometimes.
Suppose somebody presented to you, let's say, something that would be analogous to a Mapplethorpe on vinyl.
I think that everything has its audience.
Mm-hmm.
And you, and like I say, you have to find out who your audience is and how to get there.
Uh-huh.
That simple.
Yeah.
And whether, and they'll tell you whether they'll accept it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we may, you know, we're not talking reality here. We're talking about somebody's perception of it.
Right.
If you're talking about a record company.
Right. Right.
Well, reality is the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why it's
the truth.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate truth.
That's the only judge of your talent.
Right. Exactly. Whether they buy. Who are you holding up, buddy?
I was going to ask Harvey to judge this CD here.
Oh.
I'd like him to tell me, if he can, what part of the world these people are from. It's kind of a loaded question. I can see the look on his face now. And but the name of the band is, I found these guys on the net. They had pieces of their cuts on there, and I asked them to send me a CD. Now, the name of the CD, the name of the band is Tommy Cougar and the Junkyard Kings.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and it's a picture of a woman in the back of the trunk, looks like a 56 Ford.
Thunderbird,
right?
Yeah.
And I like this band. Now, let's play it for Harvey, and let's see.
All right, the cover looks like it came straight out of a diner.
Right.
And it's
called Rough and Dangerous, Slide Guitar, Juke Joint Blues.
And go ahead and send us your CDs, folks, because we do definitely like new artists, and
we really
appreciate
do.
People that have the balls to put money into their music. So you just
go
ahead and send them to us. Here's Tommy Cougar. I hope.
Show me what you got. We got a band that's rockin' and roll. We can make a swing.
Diggity dog. Okay, now, $20 million question. Who was that?
Oh, I got it. I mean, you know,
Tommy.
You know,
where are they
got,
from? Where are they
you know,
from?
You said, I'll never get it. It just so happens I know the group. I ran into them in a cafe in Kosovo.
No,
am I right?
No.
In Kosovo.
Kosovo.
No.
No?
No.
Oh, jeez.
Very, very close, though, Harvey. Very close.
Oh, it's in a similar region, except that it's a liberated region. So.
That hurts.
It's actually, they're, well.
Sweden.
Sweden, right. Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's, I mean, it's retro Sweden. 50s rock. I mean, it's a lot of fun, actually. It's a good, I like it.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Because I really didn't know where they were from.
Are you
I
sure
just
wasn't
heard
Kosovo?
A piece of it. you're very close. You're in the right part of the world. But it just
it hurts,
goes to
John.
Show.
I'm not right.
It just goes to show that right. There is an awful lot of blues influence in the world now.
No question about it.
And Tommy Cougar and the Junkyard Kings. I happen to like that album. I put it on and I said, "Now this is my kind of music. It's kind of loose." You know, my daughter came out, she's 15 years old. She goes, who's beautiful. That? I kind of like that.
That's fun.
Yeah. It's a good album.
Well, like they say, like my friends in Nashville say about, you know, I would say about the album is that I liked it better than the Hog Like Slop.
It says here that the CD is available at Skiv Hugget, S-K-I-V.
Well, at least are they selling it in Kosovo?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You can get it at Skiv Hugget. That's European Internet.
The UN forces have got them in their hip pockets. Yeah. Just come right up.
Oh, it says, or Crosscut Records, which has been one of our sponsors, Gene,
right.
For
I'm
some
I'm
time.
Old. Hi, Crosscut.
Yeah,
we
in
miss
Germany.
You. We love you.
Cool.
Keith.
Yeah, so.
That's fun. It was a fun cut.
If
fun
you
cut.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to play next, Jeannie?
I don't know. You have Jimmy Reed up here. So
I know. Why don't you get that up? I want to talk to Harvey about 20th Century Fox and RCA.
Okay.
When you were vice president of RCA, were you in New York City?
Yes.
Where were you in New York?
Where did I live?
I mean, just, yeah, where did you live? Where was the
Well,
office?
I was there a couple of times. I lived in Manhattan at the old Warwick Hotel.
Oh, my favorite place. I love that.
Is
hotel.
That where Dion was born?
No.
Oh, sorry.
No, but what was the name of the guy who used to hang out outside with the horns on his head?
Oh, God.
Do you remember that?
Moondog.
Yeah. That was it.
Yeah.
Killer guy.
That was an interesting place. I mean, I lived there. I actually used to, because my wife hated the thought of moving to New York.
New York.
I don't blame her.
I used to go back and forth.
Yeah,
from L.A. to New York, flights one, United Flight 1 and United Flight 2,
wow.
Or American, I remember which, every weekend.
Wow.
And then I lived in Upper Saddle River, New Jersey for a while.
Who was president of RCA at the time?
Rocco Laganestra.
Rocco Laganestra.
I had a big sign on my door, you know, in New York. It said, "Don't knock the rock."
Don't knock the rock. I remember that name.
They didn't appreciate my humor there.
How did they? How did the company do while you were there?
They did very well. I mean, RCA has handled everything. They were the number one country label. You know, they had the Red Seal label. They always made money.
Well, Red Seal, they're classical. Catalog.
We had the
untouched.
Mancinis, you know, the Al Hertz and the Mancinis. And
well, you had all the Elvis
people.
Stuff, too.
Elvis, forever.
Yeah. Forever.
Well, that was an interesting saga, you know, in the Elvis years.
Were you there when Elvis died?
No.
No.
But I was there while he was there, and I had to meet with the Colonel several times. That was
what was the Colonel like?
Yeah.
I've always wondered, what was he like?
Oh, man. I mean, what a subject. I mean, you're talking around. I was not his favorite guy.
And he wasn't yours, but.
Well, he did. I will say this, that he did respect me. I mean, he did respect.
Yeah.
I remember marching. He would have the RCA conventions, you know, like in Palm Springs in the middle of the summer.
Mm-hmm. So everybody was stuck indoors in the air conditioning.
Well, you know how hot it is in the
fly
ridiculous.
Eggs, right?
Yeah. So he would take it. We would stay at the spa hotel there. I think it's still there.
Yeah.
And marches down the street to the theater to see some stupid Elvis movie, like Double Trouble or some shit like that.
Oh, God.
And these guys were all corporate guys. And they would, with the exception of the promotion guys, who were the only ones that didn't kiss ass.
Right.
Yeah. Everybody else would start clapping at the credits. You know what I mean?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure those movies embarrassed Elvis. I'm sure they did.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so I'm there one day, and they start, you know, they start plotting. This is 7 o'clock, you know, in the evening. And they're starting to applaud at the credits. And I said to this guy sitting next to me, you know, another promotion guy, I said, don't worry, Nath, it's got to get better. Little did I know, the colonel was like right behind me and heard the remark. And later that night, they had this contest, you know, a bond contest for your successful participation in an Elvis thing, you know. And everybody got a prize except me.
Did you feel a little left out there?
Not at all. It was like a badge of honor.
Yeah,
you know,
that you weren't the ass kisser.
But this guy could drive you insane. I mean, he was very hardcore guy, and all the stories you ever heard about him are true. Mm-hmm. You know?
He was a carny.
He was a carny, and also, believe it or not, you know, he started a thing, an elixir in the 50s called Hedacol.
Hadacol.
Do you remember that?
Hadacol? Sure, huge Hadacol.
It was like snake. It was snake oil.
15-18% alcohol.
Well, they didn't know that until after they sold it 3 years later.
That's
with
right.
The guys who bought it for him.
What is Hadacol for?
Hadacol was a cough medicine.
It was a cure-all.
It was huge in the South.
It was really a snake oil then.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And he owned it.
That's right.
You've got to be kidding.
No, he also managed Eddie Arnold for a while. Did you know that?
Yep.
Okay. Do you think that Elvis was on a Hadacol?
I think we all.
Colonel, give me a Cadillac and some catalog. Catalog.
Anyway, I'll make a long story short with the colonel. I mean, I was transferred out to the West Coast, you know, and anybody who was at the West Coast had to go to Palm Springs to meet with the colonel at his home. That's where he lived. And he's like to push people around, you know. He'd make them crawl.
Yeah.
And one day he said something to me, and I said, look, man, I'm going to tell you right now, straight to your face, I'm a person before I'm an RCA guy.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't take shit from anybody.
Mm-hmm. How did he respond?
he responded by saying it wasn't necessary for Harvey to come to Palm Springs anymore.
Absolutely.
Now, he never fired me. I had a couple of incidents like that, you know.
Well, how could he fire you? He didn't work for RCA.
Well, believe me.
But he had the power.
Strings. He had the pulse.
Listen, I sat there in a room with Norman, you know, the guy I was telling you about, Rocco Lagonestra.
Yeah.
And the colonel was saying to him, gee, that's a very nice pin you have on there. I mean, I was sitting right next to the guy. He said, what is that? He says, that's my 25th anniversary diamond pin, Colonel. He says, you know, Elvis and I have been here a long time. I don't have that pin. He said, well, actually, it's for RCA employees. He said, well, we have made you guys a lot of money the last 25 years. We've been like family here, you know. So the man excused himself, went in the next room. 10 minutes later, he comes back. He says, Colonel, you and Elvis's pins are in the mail. So then I knew then. I said, gee, I don't think the rules apply here.
Absolutely.
No, I guess not.
Ooh.
And it was funny. I mean,
now, why would a man like that who has the money to
everything.
Buy, who has everything,
power.
Just
power.
Power. To make people
grovel.
What a diabolical piece of shit.
Sorry. I'll tell you, there were things about him.
I hate people like that.
Me too.
But he also was very very innovative, and he was very instrumental in all
that's no excuse.
No, I'm just telling you like it is.
Yeah.
I didn't take his bullshit.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
And he didn't fire me, you know.
Yeah.
The last thing I can tell you that I remember is when we all went to Vegas in 68. Remember when he went back for his comeback in Vegas?
Right.
So we were all there. And incidentally, it was a hell of a night because everybody who ever played Vegas was there at ringside laughing their ass off if they're going to see this rock and roll guy fall on his butt.
So you're talking about like Frank Sinatra, the Rat Pack?
They're all there, baby.
All there. Uh-huh.
All there.
Uh-huh.
Writers, I mean, in a very festive mood. Meanwhile, you couldn't get in the joint. This is the old Hilton.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
There were lines around there. I mean, there was no way they could get in there. And he really looked good, Elvis. And I mean, he made his comeback. He looked terrific, man.
In the leather suit.
He came on stage, and he didn't come on stage from the front. He came from the back.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
That little round stage.
The inspirations were on stage, but he wasn't. So they said, ladies and gentlemen, Elvis Presley. So anyway, it hit him. He was a good-looking guy. I'm a heterosexual dude here.
Oh, yeah. We know about him. But Elvis liked
it, too. I couldn't take my eyes off this guy.
Yeah.
He was
beautiful.
Pretty.
He was beautiful. Yeah,
he
was beautiful.
Pretty boy, you know. Anyway, he hit the stage, and I'm looking at all these people that play Vegas. They couldn't believe it.
Wow.
They could not believe their eyes.
Yeah.
This guy was magic, man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a reason why he was king of rock and roll, and it was there. You could cut it with a knife, and they knew it.
Yeah.
In that instant, they knew it, you know.
Then he's the man.
So, anyway, the colonel wanted to screw up everybody's traveling plans, naturally, so he invented some excuse for everybody to stay over the next day. Just to screw up the traveling plans. I mean, this is what I'm thinking, you know.
Yeah.
It's probably true. So that he went down to, like, one of those quick printers and had these little certificates made up, you know. because that was his excuse, that he and Elvis wanted to hand out these things, you know. So anyway, he handed them out to everybody, of course, except me.
You.
And then the last one, he said, you know, I was thinking about this. He said, I'm going to give one to Harvey Cooper today, you know. And I went up there. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I went up there. I grabbed it out of his hand, snatched it. You know, I said, Colonel, you and I both know one thing. I'm probably the only one here that deserves this.
What did he say?
Everybody was ashen, man. And one guy went like this.
Who was it?
Harry, I forget his last name.
Finfer?
He ran the...
I thought you were going to say Elvis.
No, I can't remember Harry's last name. God forgive me. But he was ahead of our division in Nashville.
Ah, okay.
He couldn't believe that I said what I said. You know?
Yeah. Harvey, did you ever get a chance to watch any interaction between Elvis and the Colonel?
No.
No?
I did. I remember the thing I was most impressed with, one or two visits, you know, in Palm Springs, he had a basement. And in that basement was like a war room.
Yeah.
A war room. It was all about the fan clubs all over the world. They had people there, and it was like running a government.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, they had presidents, and they had, you know, organizations, very finely honed, and newspapers, and they would get out the word.
Well, that's the way it needs to go. I mean,
and let me tell you, they were so effective that it was unbelievable. Yeah. He did teach me. He taught me a lot of things.
Well, he's a man to learn from, but I hope he didn't teach you that diabolical BS.
Well, listen, I can tell you this. I mean, I did everything. I asked to get fired, seriously, because nobody ever said that to him.
Stood up to him, huh? Yeah.
And he respected me as a man.
Listen, I do have a picture of Harvey taken at the New Porter Hotel.
Oh,
and we did
gosh.
The Fox is Hot, okay?
Yeah.
And I've forgotten, 1977, maybe?
A lot of
77,
hair.
78, lots of black hair.
A lot of hair.
A double-breasted jacket, which Harvey always had his hand inside.
Yeah.
Like this.
And I did.
You've been hanging out with those people in New Jersey too long, fella, and Chicago.
Unfortunately, this is true.
And so, and then now what we've done, we've actually left RCA and we've gone on now to 20th Century Fox. And you while you were there, they had a huge amount of hits. Dan Hill was one.
Yeah, it was interesting because there was an outgoing president who was there for a number of years, and he left, and it was not a good film.
Yeah.
I'm not want to get into that aspect of it, but I think they were going to sell it because they had lost a lot of money. At that point, and the reason I was hired there is because they knew I was hardcore. At the time I came in, there were 76 acts, and I whittled that down to 12.
To 12?
Yeah.
And what were they?
And incidentally,
you talk about corporate downsizing, Harvey.
Yeah. Well, it had to be, I'll tell you that. It had to be.
Yeah, sure.
And unfortunately, it cost me plenty, politically.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
In what
place? When you start telling people they're through, and, you know, and their friends tell their friends, and the people, there's about six people who run the business.
You're a rat bastard.
And this guy's crazy. He's a loose cannon. You know, he's liable to do anything.
Well, listen, we were talking outside, Jeannie, and Harvey told me about a party they threw for him when he left 20th Century Fox Records.
Yeah.
What would tell us about that party?
When I left 20th Century, the former, the guy that I replaced and a few of my dear friends showed up at an I Hate Harvey Cooper party.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
People that you had gone out of your way to keep
in
the company.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a funny town. It's a small town.
They did not.
Yes, they did.
It was really a serious I Hate Harvey Cooper
absolutely.
Party?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
And people who I had, you know, in my opinion, I gave started their careers and gave them jobs, and they went there and looking. And I've had two or three of them through the years call me and apologize to me for
what
being
did they
there.
Hate you for? Because you were forced to downsize. You had been asked to do an ugly job.
A number of things.
Or did you do that ugly job with a smile?
Well,
and that's what they hated.
It's called a profile. I mean, I was known as a loose cannon. Very blunt man, you know, things like that.
You're in good company here. That's the reason why we're all here today.
You know, but you know, it's an interesting thing, and I don't take it personally because there are people like me who have similar profiles that are poison to corporations.
Yeah,
that's right.
I was never able to get another job, even though I took that place in 18 months, John. We had 10 top 10 singles.
That's right.
5 platinum albums and 3 gold, 18 months.
My God. Was their problem?
Me.
Well, they can kiss our wet one. What do you got up here?
You know, I told you to put the wrong one on. Actually,
I got this one over here. I got Jimmy Reed ready for you, and I got your Boom Boom ready.
I know
for
you got that, but you know what? We're running out of time. And,
so what
and
do you
Harvey
want?
Has something now that he's working on that's new.
Vesica?
Vesica, which means we're going to have to put it in the...
Then you stall for time while I go do this stuff, okay?
Tell us about Vesica Pisces.
Well, this is you know, something that's brand new. I don't live, you know, it's funny. I don't live in the past, and I don't live in the future. I live in the present, you know, and... whenever I get a good piece, when somebody comes to me that I think is extremely talented, you know, it really thrills me. I love it, you know. And this is somebody who came to me yesterday. I got this in the mail yesterday. I'll probably be working on it the first of the week.
Does she know that she's
going to
be played here?
No.
No. No, she doesn't.
Vesica, congratulations. You've hit the big time. you're on BluePower.com today.
Yeah, you know, we have a
thanks to Harvey.
We haven't even mentioned
sounds
our,
like a young Joplin
call
to me. I mean, see
today.
What you think.
Yeah.
A young Joplin.
Yeah. She sounds,
okay.
That's what she sounds like to me. I mean, if they cut her loose, she would be a Joplin.
Just cut one, Jeannie.
Cut one?
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to Vesica. And she's actually a very beautiful blonde. And this song would be called Pamela?
Pamela. Yeah.
Cool.
Pamela's calling, she hasn't slept a wink. She's driving in from Washington with a carload of everything. And she sees quite clearly where she'll be in 5 years or so. Singing from real stages and wearing brand new clothes, yeah. What she has to say. He's comforting but distracted. Yeah, he's watching the Lakers game. I know one day you'll get there, honey. As it
Okay, that was Kelly Fitzgerald with Vesica Pisces. And, hey, who brought in that dang theme music? What does it mean? It's over already?
Absolutely, Jeannie. We
oh,
got to go.
Oh.
Harvey's got hits to cut, you know.
Harvey,
lives to ruin.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Harvey, that group, Vesica Pisces, is happening. Good luck with them.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Harvey, thank you so much
anytime,
for being here.
Anytime.
Yeah, where we go.
All right.
Yeah. I want to thank everybody that helps make this show possible today. Mr. Mike Toth.
Hi, Mike.
Got Mr. Mike Toth in San Francisco, who is our webmaster. Okay. Mr. David Kimmelman, who's head of marketing. Mr. Alec Biggleson, who's our banker. And
David Kimmelman's one of the loves of my life.
Isn't he wonderful?
He's a great guy.
Mr. Michael Martinez. And we have a new person on the list now, Mr. Paul Rabbit.
Paul Rabbit?
Of Rabbit Analytics, yeah, who's going to be working with us, and we'll have him on one of these days. But Harvey, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule, man.
Anytime.
And coming to hang with us. And
it's my pleasure.
We didn't get to rip everybody I'd like to, so maybe you could come back.
Yeah, will you come back and see us again, Harvey? You are absolutely one of the greatest
interviews
we've had.
We left out Alan Livingston altogether.
Anytime, you two. Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Well, John, I guess you and I are on our way out again.
That's right, babe. Thank you so much, Jeannie. I love you.
I love you too, John. Thank you so much. And everybody, be sure to send us emails and let us know how you feel about the shows. Send us your music if you've got it. And God bless you all. Have a great, great day.
Take care of your bad self.
And your good self too, but the bad self is more fun. Hasta la later, everybody.
Bye.